So actually, we have no parameter people here at all, right?
Well, Rob will come.
Huh?
I think he's
probably going to come to do.
Sorry?
Thank you.
He's also chatted.
He was once, not anymore. But are we sure this is recording? That's the question.
Yeah.
Because usually you say, you've checked it?
Well, they said, but I'll check it.
Huh?
Yeah, I'm checking that in the ballot.
Okay, thank you.
I was just told that you're not going to be here.
I went to the passport office and I still got here in time.
Oh, good.
There was no light.
So, remember our agreement? I'm waiting. Don't ask me my age or what the day of the week it is. Now I have to ask some questions about physics. Yes, good.
So
number one.
You've been mentioning that the wave function.
Yes.
You've been mentioning the wave function corresponds to an ensemble problem.
Yeah.
We really test it if we have a full ensemble.
Yeah.
In the derivation yesterday of the Born rule, you're treating each wave function as belonging to a single particle.
Yes.
How does this conceptual distinction work?
Let's see, where did I use the wave function?
You started with the tensor product of n copies of a state. It said each copy belonged to one particle.
In the Born rule, indeed, I said that if I want to find not a property of the system, but the probability that from this system I will go to another system, that is what happened in a strong experiment. From that question, I have to use the state for the individual problem. But that's a good question, and we have more to say later. But you passed number one test, and still waiting for one more. Yes.
Might not be a good one. Is there any complication due to the measuring process taking more than 0 hours of time?
That's a good question.
Okay,
good. And in fact, not this session, and maybe not the next one, but after that I will devote a whole session to the issue of quantum measurements, and there exactly this question will play a very important role. So there will be a full session discussing all kinds of features of quantum measurements, and that will be one important feature. Good. So
well, now the problem is, you said
now,
two questions from students.
Now you passed the test, so I'm allowed to talk. I would like to start by reviewing again the subject I discussed at the end of last session, namely the quantum walk. I think the quantum walk is a very important concept, and I think I went over it too fast, and I want to make it absolutely certain that I present it in a way that you will all understand it. So let me do it again very carefully. I have a problem in one dimension. And I first consider a classical random walk, which says the following. I have a classical particle described by a point. And I want to move the particle. And my method of moving it is doing the following. I throw a coin, classical coin. If the coin falls one side, I move the particle a distance delta L to the right. And if the coin falls on the other side, I move the particle a distance delta L to the left. And I repeat this n times. So after the first throw, I again throw the coin again. I will either move it further away or back to the center. And the question is, what will be the distribution of particles on which I have done this experiment n times, throwing the coin n times? And it's a well-known, the distribution, it's a Poisson distribution. The maximum distance that the particle can go happens if all the time the coin fell on the same side. And that distance will be n times delta L, which is I define as being L. And this has a probability of 1/2 to the power n. Very, very rare. I will call this, if n is extremely large, this will be a classical mirror, a classical miracle. A classical miracle is a situation that can happen but with an exponentially small probability. For example, this mirror can suddenly jump up. This is consistent with classical physics. It corresponds to an exponentially rare initial condition for all the atoms of the mirror that will happen in such a way that at given in some time they will all move in the same direction. This is very, very rare. That's why we don't see it, but if we see it, it's not against the laws of physics. It doesn't happen because it has very, very small probability. So a classical miracle is something that can happen according to the rules, and in fact I could prepare an initial condition that will make it happen, but in general in nature, I don't see those things. Like I don't see a violation of the second law, that's because that thing is so rare that there is no chance that I will see it. Similarly, if n becomes extremely large, the probability that the particle will cover this distance, L, when n becomes extremely large, begins to look like a classical miracle, because the probability, again, becomes exponentially small, and any finite number of experiments will do, our probability of getting it is negligible. Goes to zero when n is sufficiently large. And of course, if we look at the where most of the times I will find a particle, most of the time I will find a particle in around zero with a spread that grows as square root of n times delta n. So each time we come to this particle and find it, say, n, and some finite times time delta times square root of n, that becomes more smaller and smaller probability, like e to the minus that number of steps. So this, I think everybody understands classical. Now I want to show that in quantum mechanics, I can do something analogous to that, but I will get a new type of miracle that I will call a quantum miracle. And this quantum miracle will be such that after I do n steps, I will find a particle with very rare probability even 100 times further than the maximum classical distance. And that comes because of the properties of weak values, that they can be larger than the maximum eigenvalue. And so this will be a very dramatic and way for you to picture what weak values mean. So this will be a quantum miracle in the sense that I could not prepare a quantum system to begin with that will do this. It will only be successful. I will only be successful if I'm allowed to use both pre and post selection. So a classical miracle is starting with rare initial conditions and getting something very strange. Quantum miracle is something that I cannot start with the initial conditions that will do it. I must do rare initial and rare final boundary conditions. And only the combination of both of them will give me something that I call quantum miracle. So quantum miracle is something that happens very early, but in a way that I could not prepare it by initial condition. So that's how it differs from classical miracle. All right. Now, the reason to talk about miracles is not because I expect them to happen, but because when you look about extreme cases, you find features that later will appear in less dramatic way in usual experiments. You know, it's always good when you try to understand a new subject to look at extreme cases. So when I look at extreme cases of very, very rare boundary condition and find most of the properties, the new properties that I see there, I know then how to look for more mundane experiments that will show the same effect less dramatically. That's why I'm interested in doing first of these extreme situations. Yes?
How does the probability of that dramatic event depends on n? How does the, what's the probability of
you
that dramatic
event? You will see it. Of course, it will be it's smaller than 1/2 to the power n. The more I want it to be, it will be, you will see, this will come out in the calculation. But certainly right. It must happen even with smaller probability. But I'm restricted to do it only n times. So classically, I could never go more than n times delta n. In quantum mechanics, I do n throwing of this coin, the same n, and with probability much smaller than 1/2 over n, I will get a step that is much bigger, as you will see. Okay? So how do I generalize the classical, this classical type of experiment to a quantum experiment? So obviously what I have to do is two things. First of all, I have to assume that the thing that is moving now is not described by a point, but is described by a vector in Hilbert space, which in the positional presentation will be the wave function. But then I would like also to generalize the coin. I want to see what is the analog, what is new when I consider in quantum mechanics a coin that can give me one or two answers. Obviously, that is a situation in Hilbert space where I have a Hilbert space of two dimensions. In Hilbert space of two dimensions, I say 1, 0 will be a coin on one side, and 0, 1 will be a coin on the other side. But the minute when I see this, I see that this quantum coin has more than just two sides, because I can describe other orthogonal states like cosine theta, sine theta, and minus sine theta, cosine theta, which will be, in a sense, a different possibility for this coin to give two answers. So I would say that a quantum coin has more than just two sides. And you will see that that possibility is the thing that leads to something new. So I then say the following. I find an experimental setup that I have shown to you let's say the following, that if this particle has a spin half with magnetic moment, I can write a situation, an experimental situation, and I told you how to do it by sweeping very quickly a magnet. I can write that after the magnet goes by, if the particle has spin up, the wave function will move by a distance delta L to the right. And if the particle has spin down, the same wave function will move a distance delta L to the left. And there can be two situations. One is delta L is large compared to the uncertainty position of the particle. Then it will go back to the classical situation. Maybe after one step, I will find the thing either here or here. And then if I do n steps, I will see that I don't see anything new compared to the classical physics. On the other hand, if delta L is small compared to delta X, then after the magnet passes by, depending on the spin, I will see that if the spin is up, the particle moves by distance delta L to the right. And if the spin is down, the particle moves to a distance delta L to the left. But now when we observe it, we say, there is a beginning of possibility of having interferences here, right? And maybe by interferences here, we get something new. And lo and behold, this is unbelievable. You would think that the best way to move it as far as possible to the right would be just to make the step to the right. But quantum mechanics surprisingly tells us that by adding coherently interfering, moving to the right, and moving to the left, you get more moving to the right. This is a new thing about what's happening here. By mixing, not going to the right, going to the right and going to the left, I get a step that is bigger to the right. And that is the meaning of which value that is outside the range of the eigenvalues. So let's see how it works. Are there any questions so far? Yes?
I have a question about how does that work in the context of relativistic systems? How does that work in the context of relativity? So you don't want to move too fast to the right so that you don't want to break.
No, the experiment that I do lasts a finite time, of course.
Yes, yes.
And certainly the time that it lasts, time C is much, much bigger than this delta L. Remember what is the experiment. The experiment is the following. I first of all go to a frame in which the magnet is at rest. So if here this is position S, I have here in this region of space, I have a constant magnetic field pointing in this direction. Okay? That is static here. Some size of magnet. So I simply have here, at this point of space, I have BZ is equal to BZ is equal to some constant B0 that is only in this region of space. Okay? Now, if I have a particle with magnetic moment, I know that the interaction between the particle and the magnetic moment is minus nu times sigma z times bz. This is the interaction that the spin has with the magnetic moment. That means that if I put the spin here, I see it has two possible potentials. If sigma z is one value, the potential is positive. Sigma z is another value, the potential is negative during this whole period. Now I choose my particle to move with velocity. First of all, average velocity is very, very large compared to the uncertainty velocity. So imagine a particle described by Gaussian. It has the following property. First of all, it moves extremely fast compared to its uncertainty. That means that for a long time, if I do doing this experiment, particle will move long distances before I have to start to worry about its spread. So I can neglect the spread, okay, during the whole experiment. Second, the energy of this particle is so big compared to the potential that I'm doing here. So when the particle will come by, it will speed by. And the only thing that will happen to it is that while it's here, it will move slightly slower if the potential is positive, and slightly higher if the potential is negative. And depending on the range where this potential is, I can raise the wave pressure will be shifted compared to its free motion. It comes up to here when it goes out, but it will come out slightly shifted to the right if the speed is up, and slightly shifted to the left compared to what it would have done without the magnetic field. And this will be my step. Now, I want to look at it in a frame where the particle is at rest and the magnet is moving. It's the same thing. And then the magnet will be moving like this, very fast. That particle will sit here. And when the magnet comes to the other side, I will see that the particle has shifted without changing its shape. Its shape has shifted by delta L to the right to sigma z is up, and by delta L to the left, it's sigma z is down. Any questions about this?
So how that spin is, if the particle is spinless, then...
What do you mean?
If there is no spin for the particle.
Then I can do my experiment. You know? I'm just trying to do an experiment that will be successful if I have a particle with spin half. The fact is that if I wouldn't have a particle with no spin, I couldn't do the experiment. I don't care less of it. Okay? If somebody wants to come and measure the charge of the electron by using the famous experiment, who did it, Millikan? Oh, yeah. Then you tell this guy, oh, what's taking me my time? Suppose the particle did not have a charge, your experiment will not work. He will not mind. Okay, so this is not a critic. Yes.
No, but more seriously, this is just one possible experiment. There may be many different methods.
Of course, of course. For me, just enough to. I could even say I don't know how to do it. It's a Duncan experiment. So this here, I say, look, it's more than a Duncan experiment because in principle, it can actually be done in the laboratory. So it's somewhat nicer. I didn't have to do it. I could have just discussed a Duncan sort of experiment. All right. So. Let's then conclude what happens after one such step. So I can write the answer for what happens. I can say that if the spin is up, I say that I see here e to the I px delta L times the state of the particle, psi is the state of the particle. So if I start with spin up, after the magnet went by, I see that the change in psi will be by a shift delta L, and this shift delta L is described by the operator e to the I px delta L times psi. And if the spin is down, I know that I will have e to the minus I px delta L times psi. But this can be written concisely by saying that after one step, the particle was shifted by e to the I px times Fz times delta L. So this is the effect. This is the effect on what happens to psi if I know Fz. If Fz is plus 1, it shifts this way. If Fz is minus 1, but this is the unitary evolution after one step for with this operator and this operator, okay?
Times the state of the spin.
Hmm? Yeah, I know. Yeah. And then there you see here the state of the spin. Let's call the state of the spin phi. Then just two vector in Hilbert space. Now, I say the following. I did not finish yet my business. After the whole thing is over, I have to decide how did the coin come up. So I have to see whether the coin was showing up or down. That will be to check whether Sz is plus or minus. But instead, I could check another possibility. I could check a possibility by doing an experiment to post-select the spin, to post-select the spin along some other direction. So I can, for example, discuss to make an experiment that one outcome of it will be cosine theta times sigma z equals to plus 1 plus sine theta times sigma z equals to minus 1. And the other outcome is the orthogonal thing, minus sine theta sigma z equals to plus 1 plus cosine theta sigma z equals to minus 1. Meaning that I can come now, after this, look at the spin of my particle and make a measurement of some operator, Hermitian operator in this two-dimensional Hilbert space. So that Hermitian operator may be, for example, instead of measuring the spin in the z direction, I measure the spin in some tilted direction in the zx plane. Because these are real, this is in the zx plane. So I measure the spin in some different direction in the HZ plane, and get plus 1 or minus 1. If I get plus 1, I know that the spin now will be in this state. And what will happen here to psi, I have to do the following. I say, I start with the spin, I start with the state phi. Let me remind you, the state phi was the state sigma z equal to plus 1 plus sigma z equal to minus 1 divided by square root of 2. Namely, I started my coil in the x direction, so that if I would check whether sigma z up or sigma z down, I would get exactly probability 1/2. That is perfect coil. But now I say, instead of looking whether sigma z is plus or sigma z is minus to see if I got a step to the right or a step to the left, I'm now allowed to look at another direction and possess this state either with one of them or the other, depending on which answer I'm getting. So if I get, for example, this answer, I know now that from now on the spin will be pointing in this direction. And the amplitude to get it is the scalar product of that spin with this one. And that will be the thing that will be left acting on the particle. So let's do the calculation. You will see immediately that if this is the result, I will leave it to you to check by this theory, I will get the statement cosine theta e to the I px delta L plus sine theta e to the minus I px delta L x t 1 phi, and the state of the spin here.
Psi.
Huh?
Psi. Psi is the state of the particle.
Psi. And the state phi, and the state phi will be the eigenstate cosine theta times up plus sine theta times down. So this will be the state phi prime now, which is in this direction theta. This finished my one step. So my one step now is, after this one step, I see that the particle moved in this way, it's a linear superposition of moving to the left and moving to the right, and there could be interference between the two, we'll see that that's important. And the spin now, instead of pointing in this direction, is pointing now in this theta direction. So now what I do, I come to this spin and rotate it back to the x direction. I rotate it back to the x direction, I can start now anew. I can do the same thing again. And again and again. And therefore, I ask, what will happen if n times I was successful to find all the time that particular answer? This will be the equivalent thing to happening all the time, the coin is falling up. So here, all the time, this new kind of coin follows up n times, and that's what happens now. Let me just, before I ask the question, let me ask. So I'm saying the following. If I'm successful n time, each time I come, I'll take the spin back, do the experiment, take the spin in the other direction, I'm successful. Then I see that this, I have to multiply the particle by this, and again do it again. So the final answer will be, if I'm successful in all of them, will be cosine theta e to the I ps delta a plus sine theta e to the minus I ps delta a to the power n, act on the state of the particle, and the state of the spin will be again the same as at the beginning. The important thing is to understand what will be the situation. That's why we will see the superoscillation. Now, you wanted to ask a question?
Yes, how do you return the spin back?
If I know that I have a spin in this direction, and some is a magnetic field in the y direction, which makes a precession in the xz plane, I switch it just the right time, that it will be spin back to s.
That's the only change to that wave function.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, because it does affect the spin. Okay? All right, now, let me write delta L as equal to the maximum classical distance divided by large L, okay? The same number as the experiment. So therefore, I have to calculate now what happens if I have cosine theta e to the I px L over N plus sine theta, this is operator, sine theta e to the minus I px L over N to the power N. This is the operator that will act on the particle if I'm successful N times to find my coin, quantum coin, falling up. Up in the direction, right? And now, I know that I can do now, if I assume that L is finite and N is very, very large, I can do here an expansion of the exponent. Suppose, by the way, that this S in representation where the momentum is definite. In that representation, this is simply a number, e to the I ps L over N, right? And then, so I can treat it just like a normal function. And I say that if I go at the limit of N going to infinity, that means that I decide that in each step, my magnet will move very, very little amount. And I need a huge number of steps before I get to the maximum limit under the normal coins. Okay? I'm looking at this situation. What will happen if I found my new kind of coin successful all the time? So under this condition, I'm saying that if I look at a particle whose momentum is not too big, for example, I have a Gaussian, so the momentum, I want to make sure that the momentum times L divided by N, if N is sufficiently large, is a small number, so that I can neglect the square of it. And obviously, if I start the particle with a Gaussian, then the probability to find the very large momentum of the order N goes like e to the minus N squared, so I can neglect it. Therefore, I can expand this thing to first order. And I see here cosine theta times 1 plus I px L over N plus sine theta times 1 minus I px L over N to the power N. So I see that I get cosine theta plus sine theta times 1 plus I times cosine theta minus sine theta times Ps A over N. Right? Am I correct? I have to take this to the power N. Now let me say divide by cosine theta plus sine theta to the power N. So I can rewrite the whole thing as cosine theta plus sine theta to the power N multiplied by 1 plus I PXL over N times cosine theta minus sine theta divided by cosine theta plus sine theta. And all this to the power N. So now, this is a number. This is something 1 over n to power n. I know that as the limit when n becomes very large, I can write it as an exponential. So this thing is now a very small number, because I'm going to have cosine theta plus sine theta much smaller than 1 to make it interesting. So this may be a very small number. It has to do with how rare is the experiment. But it has nothing to tell me what happens to the measuring device, to the psi, because only this thing is responsible for what happens to psi. This is just normalization factor. So I can forget about this. This simply tells me what is my probability to succeed in my experiment. So forget about this. And we ask now, what does this tell me when it's x to psi? So I see that I have 1 plus I PXL over N times this number, and I call this number SZ wish because I will prove it. I see this is the number of SZ wish, and I take it to the power N, and I see that this will be e to the I PXL, the N drops, times SZ width. So if SZ width will be larger than 1, this particle will be shifted by distance L times that. If I can choose, like we published in our first article, the net spin width value will be 100, then lo and behold, in this quantum miracle, if I'm successful, the particle moves 100 times more than the maximum allowed classical limit. So this shows you dramatically how interesting experiments can be done with pre and post selection and selecting which values that are completely outside the usual range. Okay? Now, why do I claim that this is the which value of SZ? Let us check it. So I started my initial state, phi initial for the spin, was the state was sigma is equal to plus 1. My final state was the state where sigma z I have to be careful which operator it is. Okay. I want to see what is the state sigma z equal to plus 1 times cosine theta plus sigma x equal to plus 1 times sine theta. Let us write this state in the representation where sigma z is diagonal. The representation when sigma, and by the way, yeah, when sigma z is diagonal, sigma z equals minus 1 times sine theta, right? That's what we have. Sorry. So that state in this representation is simply the state cosine theta and sine theta, right? This is the state in the representation. And now, this is the final state. And the initial state was the state 1, 1. That was Eger's state. So if I want to calculate sigma z width, let's calculate sigma z width for this situation. So I have to take the vector from the future as a bra. It's cosine theta, sine theta. I have to put here the operator sigma z, which is 1 minus 1, 0, 0. I have to put here the initial vector 1, 1. This will be, and I have to divide by the scalar product cosine theta, sine theta, with 1, 1. This is the way to calculate the width value.
Just put a minus.
No, yeah, minus here. Yes, thank you. I said it and I missed it. Okay, so you see, this is, remember the width value is psi final, the operator sigma z, psi initial, divided by psi final, psi initial. Right? Okay? So at the bottom I see cosine theta plus sine theta. And at the top I see cosine theta minus sine theta. So indeed, this was exactly what we had there. We had there, remember, cosine theta plus sine theta divided by cosine theta minus sine theta. That is the thing that multiplied.
Other way around,
thank you. Right. Good. I make it purposely to see if you follow me, okay? All right, so we've shown now that in this quantum walk, by pre-impulse selection, we render our coin, which tells us that it pushes the particle by sigma z, we render the coin to push the particle each time, not by the maximum eigenvalue, which is 1, but by arranging pre-impulse selection in other direction, we render it to push the particle each time by sigma width, provided the step in each time was very, very small compared to the uncertainty, so that this will be a width measurement for each shade. And now we have seen, therefore, that this quantum walk, is a beautiful way to realize what happens when you have a situation that the width value of the thing that is responsible for the walk here is much larger than the eigenvalue. Now, I will have intermission. After that, I will just very briefly connect it with super oscillation again, and then we'll come to some other things. But maybe let me use a few minutes for fun. Sometimes we should have, this is fun also, but I want to have even more fun with physics. I will have one interesting fun story. Okay. So the fun story is the following. When I first heard about the Zeno effect, and I started to think about it, I thought that I could find I saw that maybe people were completely stupid because they were not doing the right thing, maybe. I said the following. What does the Zener effect is? I have, for example, an atom that is excited. And I know that after a while, the atom will emit a photon. And people in the old days were calling it a jump. Namely, at some unknown time, the whole photon came out. And the question was, at what time did it come out? Can we find out when exactly did it come? Did it leave the atom? So people say, well, let us check it. Let us look at time, whether the atom is still excited or not. And it was found out that if you try to look very carefully, at times very small compared to the usual lifetime, to see if it's already decayed or not, you slow the decay very much until at the end, if you want to be very, 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 very serious, it will never happen, okay? And then they invented the things, they invented to this idea a number of names. One is the name what kettle never boiled. This comes from the fact that British gentlemen like to have very much their tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this particular lord was sitting and waiting and waiting, and he couldn't get his tea. He got very mad. He went to the kitchen and looked at the man and said, what happened? He said, it's going to boil any minute. He said, I'm going to see that it's going to boil. He looked and looked and looked, and lo and behold, because he was so anxious to get it, his time went so slowly that it took for him ages before the kettle boiled. So this is the English saying, watch kettle never boil. Don't watch it if you want it to boil. Then there is another example, the famous Greek philosopher Zeno said, look at this problem. I have Achilles, who is the faster runner known to us. And I have a turtle, which is the slower animal. I will prove to you that Achilles will never overtake the turtle. How do I prove it to you? I only want you to give me one thing, that Achilles will start here, and the turtle, I don't know how to draw turtle. So this is A and this is C. Here the turtle is here, initially, and Achilles is here, okay? Now, then you say, look, you agree that in order to reach the turtle, first Achilles must come to the place where the turtle was, right? But by the time he reached here, even though the turtle is moving very slowly, it's not there anymore, right? It's not there anymore. It's here. Okay, now Achilles has to come this distance to catch the turtle. But the turtle again will not be there anymore. It will be someplace else. Each time when Achilles comes to the place where the turtle was, the turtle is not there anymore. So we will never reach it. Never, okay? Something might be wrong, but anyhow, that's the famous Zeno paradox. It has to do with the fact that you can add infinite number of things until you get a fine number. You know, if you add 1 plus half plus quarter plus 1/8 ad infinity, you get the value 2. So you have infinite number of instruments that add up to some final time. These are the times that it takes him to do it. But Achilles was a Zeno did not know about this possibility. Okay, so we have this thing in the folklore. And now why did people claim in quantum mechanics that something like this, similar to this, happened? I will show it to you in a very simple example. That, I always like to play with spin half because this is a simple quantum system. So I have a spin half pointing in the XY plane, pointing initially in the X direction. And I have a magnetic field, constant magnetic field, in the Z direction. So I know that this particle starts to process, and there will be, after finite time, it will be completely in this direction. But I am curious to see when did it go from being in this direction to being in this direction. So I keep checking very carefully. Is it still here? Is it still here? Is it still here? Then we find that it will always be here. And to prove this, it's very easy. You say the following. If I check, if I look at the period, if I say that there is a period T for which I know that it will sum from here to here, this is sort of the lifetime. Let me divide this T by a large number and call this delta T. And let me check every delta T if the particle is still here or not, when n is very, very large. So if I come after the first time, I know that quantum mechanics tells me that actually the particle went here a distance of an angle, which is of the order of T over n, right? But I want to see if it's here. What is the probability to find it here? 1 minus cosine squared theta, where cosine is this angle. Sine squared theta, sorry. The probability to find it here is there is a probability to be in the orthogonal state, which is sine theta. So, in fact, the probability to find it here after one time is 1 minus delta t squared. And therefore, it's 1 minus t squared over n squared. What? Approximately. And therefore, if I ask what happens if I do it n times, and if I do it n times, that's exactly altogether the time that if I did not look, it will come to here. The probability that I will still find it all the time here is this to the power n, and when n goes to infinity, this remains 1. So therefore, this is a very simple calculation. That's not what I'm after. I want to tell you what I thought about it. So I looked at it, and I say, oh, everybody is stupid. Why did they try to do be very curious this way? Let's be very curious the way that quantum mechanics tell us to be curious. Namely, let us do in this case that first it was here, and then it was here, and then it was here. Let's do this experiment, and then we will be able to follow exactly what quantum mechanics is telling us. And know this experiment at all. Lo and behold, I can be as curious as I like, provided I do the right experiment. So instead of checking when did it jump from here to here, I will check exactly follow what the motion that quantum mechanics predicts. For example, in the case of the atom and the photon, the thing that I have to follow is a very complicated thing. I have to check that first I have the atom here. Then I have the atom with very short probability amplitude to 1, plus a small amplitude of a photon. Then more amplitude. Then I can do this experiment following very carefully what quantum mechanics is telling me without disturbing the system at all. I was very happy. I found a way to take care of this whole business and show that it's not interesting, perhaps. I went to sleep. In the morning, many times happened to me in the morning that I discovered how stupid I was in the evening. So in the morning I wake up and I suddenly ask myself, hey, what happened if there was no magnetic field at all? And I keep checking whether this is what's happening. And lo and behold, I will find it. Why? Because now it's exactly the same calculation as before. So now there is no magnetic field at all. I believe that there was a magnetic field. I made this experiment to check if I'm right and found that I'm right. Aha! Uh-huh. So now this is much more interesting. I should say now the following statement. What kettle always boils, even if there is no fire underneath? Okay? This is a much more interesting statement. Namely, if I take the kettle that is under, and I calculate its wave function, and ask how the wave function of all its molecules will shift after a short time if there is a fire underneath. I check whether this happens even if there is no fire underneath, and I find it with exactly the probability 1 minus 1. Then I continue to do the thing. I will make the kettle boil just because I measured it, because I believe that it's supposed to get boiled. Okay? This is now Very interesting. So now we say, if you have any belief about any computational system, you believe it strongly enough, you check it, you will always find it. Take any orbit in Hilbert space of any computational system, check very carefully that this is happening, you will find it, independent of what the Hamiltonian is. There is more serious things to say about it at some later, but I thought that this would be nice fun to talk about. So remember now, what shatter always boils, even if there is no fire underneath. That's much more interesting, right? Okay, now we have intermission. I said that I have more things to say about the idea, the mathematics of this super oscillation, but I prefer to delay this to some later session, and now to continue with some interesting, more directly physical properties of what we are talking about. The first general comment is the following.
Can I ask a question before you proceed?
Yes.
Do you have any deep statement about free will regarding to the last comments you were saying?
Yeah, what?
Free will.
Free will.
You bet he has.
What? What?
You bet he has.
What you were saying in the end, before the intermission, right?
Yeah.
I assume it has the dramatic implications for the free will.
You mean the...
Because you say whatever you believe in.
The kettle.
Well, kettle and stuff.
Well,
it has... Will it take us too far out?
Yeah, first of all, it takes us too far out. And second, it has very important implication in understanding the Feynman approach to quantum mechanics. What Feynman suggests is you take any possible orbit and give it equal probability and then add up with amplitude with phases that correspond to the classical election. I published an article with one of my students, I think it was mostly Vardy, I'm not sure, where we showed that if I just follow. Oh, it was David Allen? You sure? Oh, well, anyhow, the idea was the following. You got me digression just a few minutes. Okay, the idea was that we want to see how the particle starts at one point, time t1, and goes to another point at time t2. So we say, now let's believe that it goes this way. We check it, we find. Indeed, it goes this way. Let it believe that it goes this way. Any way that we will check, we find with equal probability. Exactly what Feynman told us. Then, what will happen if we make an experiment in which we choose another variable to tell us that this variable is up, it goes this way. If the variable is down, it goes this way. Then we can find out what is the relative phase between the two. And the relative phase happens to be exactly the classical action. So then, this new approach, saying that every belief is materialized, can give a very interesting measurement content to the Feynman procedure. But we'll have more to say about it later. How it is connected to free will, the connection to free will is very, very subtle in all our discussion. And I promise to have a whole I am freely proposing now that there will be some time, some session in the future where I will discuss free will very deeply. And I hope I have enough free will to make sure that this will happen. Okay?
By the way, this was in Bhakti.
Huh?
It was in Bhakti.
Was this?
The paper.
Yeah.
Bhakti.
Oh, it's Bhakti? You were right? Good.
No, I was wrong.
Oh, it was Bhakti.
It was Bhakti.
Oh, okay. So I was right. Ah, good. No, with Albert, I did all things about multi-time measurements and this sort of thing. Yeah, right. Okay. So the first general thing that I want to discuss is developing more physical insight. What does it mean to get weak values that are outside the range? So now I want to prove a general theorem. The general theorem says the following. If I look at an operator A that has eigenvalues discrete eigenvalues that are between, that are in some given range. So there is a maximum value for A and a minimum value for A. Then I can say that if I get a weak value for A which is larger than that, it means that it goes beyond the eigenvalues. I want to show a theorem that something must happen in this situation. I can write every operator A as the sum of projection operators on, let me define projection operator as the state alpha, as alpha n, where A times alpha n is equal to the number alpha n, alpha n. So A, if A is discrete, it has finite values, it has a finite number of eigen vectors and a finite number of projection operators. That projection operator is a projection operator that projects you on a particular eigenvalue. Yes?
Some people will find it very confusing notation.
Yeah?
Because that was like the product.
Maybe use capital P.
No.
Latin P for the projection.
Or put the
instead
N,
of the product.
Just put the N as an upper index.
Oh, oh, you mean here, here.
Yeah,
this one. Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Confusing.
Pi N.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Oh, by N. Oh, the inside.
Yeah, how about Latin P? Would
huh?
that work better?
No, but put also down maybe
N. Oh, yeah, 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 of course. Sorry. You are completely right. So anyhow, I can write the operator A as a sum of projection operators on eigen vectors of A multiplied by the eigen value. Now, I know that A weak, the weak value of A, is equal to the sum of the weak values of pi n. This is a theorem that is true about weak value. The weak value of a sum of operators is equal to the sum of the weak values. That we are using, you can trivially see. If I calculate psi 2, pi 1 plus pi 2 times psi 1 divided by psi 2 psi 1. So this is the, I calculate the weak value of the sum of pi 1 plus pi 2. Now you trivially see that because it's a sum, this is equal to psi 2 pi 2 psi 1 plus psi 2 pi 1 psi 1. Right? So obviously, the weak value of a sum of operators is equal to the sum of the weak values. The weak value of the product is not equal to the product of weak values. That's why it makes life interesting. Otherwise, there will be nothing interesting. But the weak value of the sum is equal to the sum of the weak values. Now, I want to have this weak value larger than alpha maximum. Right? How could this happen? If all the weak values here would be positive, like average of projection operator between, your average between 0 and 1 must always be positive, right? If it's an average. So if each one of those is positive, a sum of positive things times alpha n can never give you alpha larger than that. That must mean that the weak value of some of the projection operator must be negative. For example, the simplest...
The main ingredient is that the sum of all them must be
equal to
1.
The sum is always 1, right. Yeah. Now, for example, let's look at just sigma z. We said that we can have a situation where sigma z weak is equal to 2. Okay? How could this happen? We know that sigma z weak is equal to the weak value of minus 1, that's the projection operator on minus 1 times minus, What? What is it?
Write it like pi.
Okay, let me write it like this. This is equal to minus 1 weak value times my times minus plus one weak. So this minus that, the weak value of the plus minus the weak value of the minus is equal to sigma z weak. The weak value of the plus the weak value of the minus must be equal to 1. Because I know that the sum is a unit operator. So I have now two conditions. Let's call this number
pi minus. Call it pi minus.
What? Okay, pi minus, okay. Anyhow, so I have pi minus plus pi plus is equal to 1. Pi plus minus pi minus is equal to 2, all right? These are my two conditions. So I sum the two of them, the pi minus cancel, I see that pi plus is equal to 3. I subtract one from the other, and I see that pi minus is negative, okay? Because this pi minus that is negative. So therefore, we see a general theorem that if I have interesting situations where the weak values are outside the usual range, immediately I encounter situations where the weak value of some projection operators are negative. And I want now to see how do we analyze, how do we understand physically what's going on. And for that, I will look at a special example that we are publishing very soon after the original work on weak values that we call the three box example. I have three boxes and I know I have a single electron, and I know that I prepared the single electron in the state equal amplitude in each one of the boxes. So if I call this box number 1, this box number 2, this box number 3, psi initial, my initial state, is equal to one over square root of 3 times the state minus 1 plus, the state 1 plus the state 2 plus the state 3. Okay, the particle has equal probability to be originally in all the three boxes. I assume that each one of those is an eigenstate of energy, so nothing happens to the electron in time. There's a constant of motion. The Hamiltonian is just the free Hamiltonian, and these are eigenstates of energy. So nothing happened to this state in time. Time follows. And then, much later, I make a measurement. One outcome of this measurement, one particular outcome of this measurement, is the state 1 plus 2 minus 3. This state is not orthogonal to that, so certainly I have a probability to find it, and I'm looking now only at situations where I find this final post-reaction. So the final post-reaction psi final is equal to 1 over square root of 3, 1 plus 2 minus 3. I certainly can find such a state in the end. The probability to find it, by the way, is 1/9. The probability is 1/9, right? Because the scalar product of the two states is 1 over 3, and therefore the probability is 1/9, okay? So if I have an experiment that 1/9 of the times I will find that post-reaction, and I'm going later to look only in those cases. This is the regime we are talking about. Now, what can I say about the property of this electron in the time in between? So I first of all calculate the weak values of the projection operator. Since the scalar product of this times this is equal to 1, if I forget about the normalization, when I calculate weak values, I can forget about normalization because I multiply in the denominator and denominator by the same number. So I can always take wave functions that are not normalized. I will take now this and that to be my initial final state. The product of this times that now is exactly 1. So in the denominator will be 1. And therefore, the weak value of the projection operator, if I find the projection operator here, I get 1. If I find it supported here, I get 1. If I put it here, I get minus 1. So therefore, the projection operator has the property pi 1. The projection operator, the existence of the particle here, so to say, is with certainty 1. I use here a theorem that I will prove later, that if the weak value of an operator that has only two possible eigenvalues, if the weak value is equal to one of these eigenvalues, the strong value is also like that. I will prove it to you later. Let me put now a statement, some of you can check it if you like, that even if I would make a strong experiment, maybe if I will open this box in the middle time and check whether there is a particle here or not, provided I get this final condition, I always will find the particle there. Always. Because if I don't find the particle there, I am left with this state coming from the past, and that state coming from the past is orthogonal to that state that comes from the future. And therefore, it cannot happen. So if I open this box in the middle, for sure I will find a particle there, if I don't do anything here. And I get the final post-reaction. But if I open this box instead, lo and behold, I will also, for sure, find the particle there. I have only one particle. I find it for sure if I look at the left box. I find it for sure if I only look at the right box. If I look at both boxes, I don't see two particles. Instead, I even see less than one particle because the two things disturb each other. But if I discuss weak measurements that don't disturb each other, then now I can say that weakly, I am sure that there is a particle here weakly. I am sure that there is a particle here weakly, and I am sure there is minus particle there, and we have to understand what it means, because altogether we have one particle. So first of all, I always try to understand what's going on by envisioning that I have very rare situation where I have n particles that all of them started in this state, all of ended up in this state, and what experiments I can do in that case in the middle. The point is that, for example, if I have n particles in this box, I can measure that number n weakly so that I will measure the total number here up to an uncertainty of square root of n. That measurement will not disturb any of the individual particles because the interaction with each individual particle will be very weak, just like we discuss always measurement ensemble. So therefore, if I will measure the total number of here particles here weakly, it will still be now a robust experiment. That it will tell me there are about n particles here, plus minus square root of n. It's a robust experiment provided I interact with this in this experiment with each of the particles very weakly. That means that I am not allowed, for example, to open the box and count how many particles there are. This is a strong experiment. What can I do to check how many electrons there are here? I can measure, for example, the electric field outside many places. The electric field now will tell me quite robustly how many particles there are, because it will be much, much bigger than the quantum uncertainty of the vacuum. For a single electron, that measurement doesn't tell me if it's there or not. That is a weak measurement. But when I have enough of them, I will measure now the electric fields all around here and find that there are more or less n particles here up to uncertainty square root of n. Then I do the same thing here. I do a measurement here, and lo and behold, I find that there are also n particles here. I will measure the gravitational field. It will correspond to n times the mass here. This is a Dirac experiment because it's weak, but in principle, I find n particles here. And I come now to this business, do the same kind of measurement, and I find something very surprising. The electric field that I will find here will correspond to exactly the electric field I will find from negative charged particles. So these particles, whose projection operator is negative, I would now like to interpret as saying not that there is a negative number of particles there, but there is a particle there that has all its properties that I can measure weakly opposite than the usual normal particle. So we say, therefore, that my experiment here will tell me that there are n normal electrons here, n normal electrons here, and n new kind of particles that I don't have in nature, in fact, because this will be particles that will have the opposite charge of electron, the opposite spin, but they will also have negative mass, because also the gravitational field will be. So this is a new kind of situation that I find, that when I do weak measurements, I will find new properties of nature in the time between pre and post reaction that is extremely important. As long as this system interacts with the environment weakly, the environment will see the existence here of this new situation. That doesn't mean that the situation really exists there. For example, if there would be an electron here, they will interact with it. If there is an electron here, the interaction here between them will go as n squared. That doesn't work. So it's not that when I have four single particles, a particle here, a particle here, and the opposite particle here, they don't interact between each other because the interaction is the projector here times the projector here, which is exactly equal to zero. So we have to be very careful in how we interpret this picture. It's not that it tells us actually there are these things there and we can see them strongly on early hours, but as long as we only interact with these systems weakly, they behave to all respect like there are n particles here, and new kinds of particles. I'm debating all the time how to call these particles. And I will explain to you why, for some reason, I want to call them phantom particles. And not today, but maybe tomorrow, I will explain to you why I thought the phantom particles will be sort of the right word, that if I come very closely and look at them, they are not there. And there will be another example that will make it more dramatic to call them phantom particles, but I'm still open for suggestions how to call them. You know, when I invented the idea of weak measurements, weak values, I was also debating what name to give it. And I talked to all my friends, and those of you were there when I discussed it with them, I discussed. I said, I want to call it weak measurement, weak value. It doesn't sound exactly right, but to call epsilon now, say this is a terrible name. What does it mean to talk about weak values? Are the values weak in some sense? But nevertheless, I think that the name chosen is fine. This is going to be very important to find the right name for this phenomenon, because you will see how general it is and how many beautiful consequences will come from all this situation where the single particle is now accompanied. It can be accompanied by hundreds of them. If I get, for example, I can get the situation that the weak value will be hundreds, and then there will be hundreds of these things around, as long as they are weak. So it's a very, very rich existence in the time in between as long as we are careful to do only weak values, weak measurements. So I wanted first to make sure that you understand the connection between having weak values that are outside the range and having this situation where I have negative values. And by the way, there was a proof given by, I don't remember his name, that the connection between having negative value for the projection operator is exactly equivalent to having contextuality. And therefore, you can show that each time you have, those of you who know what contextuality means, the problem, then there is a direct connection between having weak value outside the range and the problem is contextuality. But I'm not going to push that far. This is not my game. Okay. So are there any questions about that? Yes.
Why do you go for negative mass and negative charge rather than negative number? Is there a distinct sort of reason?
Because I don't understand what negative number means. Number is counting. If I count, I don't know. I have only positive fingers. I don't know how to count negative numbers. No, really. Negative numbers like negative probabilities, it's mathematical game, but I don't know what it means. I know what it means to have opposite properties. But what does it mean to say that in this box there are -2 particles? I don't know what it means. I will know only if you tell me that if there's negative number, it means it has the opposite property. So it's much better to say there is two particles here that have the opposite property.
Is it possible to imagine particles that have the same mass but negative charge? I mean, it seems that the number of particles that is the thing that unifies here.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that we should change. Because you could have the charge is reversed, but the mass is not reversed. But that doesn't happen in this.
That doesn't happen here, yeah.
So that argues in favor of saying that you have a negative number.
No, that's
yeah, because that is the only thing that they can in common.
What?
Look, if you just look at each property separately,
yes,
you may imagine that you reverse the mass, but you didn't reverse the charge or any combination. But when the number turns out negative, everything.
No, because I can prove that because the sum of the projection operators is equal to 1, they must cancel each other when I look, for example, on the total electric field there, because it's proportional to the sum of the projection operator.
But you can have a normal particle, which, I don't know, you make the spin instead of up, you make it negative by this value, but don't change the
mass. But then when I sum the two, if I would say, for example, the charge of this is opposite, but the mass of it is the same still. Right? Then if I sum the three masses far away, I will get 3 instead of 1. Because
you change the mass in another part.
Okay. So I will have here a projection operator that is positive, it has some, it's not going to work, really. I don't understand what negative number means. I understand what it is to say that a particle has a projection operator which is negative, has all the properties that the particle with the same particle with positive projection has, but they're all of them the opposite. Right? You will see that this is okay. This is my game. I want to call it this way. First of all, there's no democracy here. But second, you will see that this is the best way to do it. Sorry? Opposite momentum.
Which is moment. All the charges
momentum.
Are changed.
I'm not sure yet. Okay, if I have, for example, angular momentum. Yeah, if I have here a particle, I have angular momentum in this way, then if it has a negative projection operator, we have opposite angular momentum, definitely.
Everything,
as long as every situation that the positive projection have positive momentum, positive mass, positive energy, positive whatever you like, the negative projection will be all of these things reversed, okay?
So everything that is multiplied by n will become negative.
Yeah, every additive thing, yeah.
So that's why you call it a negative end.
Hmm?
That's why you call it a negative end.
But it has nothing to do with being, first of all, it doesn't have to be even integer. I mean, it can be probability, it can be imaginary. You have to then to invent imaginary numbers. Look, it's another way to talk. The question is, what do you feel is more, is a language that is more physical, okay? I think that when I speak about a negative number of particles, from the beginning, I don't know what this concept means, because for me, number is counting. I don't know what it means to count a negative number. But I understand what it is to talk about a particle and say the opposite particle has properties than the other particle. That's my intuition, all right? I would prefer to do it this way, and then some people may... yes, what's your question?
Yeah, in the presence of gravity, if I have negative mass, I can create, you know, time loop or warp time travel. I mean, usually all the causality proof.
No, careful, you have to be careful. This particle has negative mass, has also negative inertia. So under given positive gravitational field, it will be pushed in the right direction.
Okay.
Yeah, it has also negative inertia. It's a game that you have to learn to play carefully, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering, have you thought about this using something like a Dirac C and having this represented by holes in the Dirac
C? No, because in the case of Dirac C, you have the power, the positron has positive mass and not negative mass. And this particle has also negative mass.
Generalizing it to some kind of mass field as well.
Well,
so you can have a hole in the mass field.
I don't know of any way to do it in field theory to have a particle that has also negative mass. So I don't know. It may be interesting to think about. Yes?
Does it create problems for the time reversal symmetry?
For what?
Time reversal symmetry.
Why?
Well, maybe not. Because
no,
you already have two times, kind of, you already have a narrow time.
No, I can prove. I can prove that if I have this initial condition and this final condition, if instead I have this as the initial condition and this as the final condition, everything will work out fine with time reversibility. You will check it. Okay, enough for today?
Well, sure, you know how to count negative numbers. You give me $1, right? You don't have to
do anything.
Sure.
No, I think about probability. I think about counting, and I don't know what it means to count a negative number. Look, it's a question of taste, all right? I believe that my taste is telling me that I think about it, to think about it not as having a negative probability to be there or a negative number, but maybe positive number with probably property. Okay, this is case we will end up probably, if we're not mistaken, not doing this test with the same answer, then the question is who will discover more interesting effects using one language compared to the other? That will be the test, okay? And so far, I'm quite successful in my test, okay? By the way, there are some copies here of an article that was written by two colleagues in mine about weak measurements, the weak measurement value that you might be interested in. Find it interesting, so you can take it from there. I hope that all of you have copies of the article that can be worked for later. Well, do you have it?
Because yeah, I sent it. It was in the email. Which one?
The one dynamic analogy?
Yeah, got it.
You all have the two links.
Okay. Because then, maybe soon, not tomorrow, but after tomorrow, we start to talk about dynamic analogy. By the way, I anticipate. How many more days do we have working days? How many more working days do we have in the conference?
So three this week and five next week.
Eight? Okay, if we come to a situation, say, there are 3 days left, and I try to say most in 2 days, would there be some volunteers here to be in two talks, one in the morning and one in the afternoon?
No.
Okay, I may have joined up doing this, okay?
Sure.
All right. Okay.